You're listening to Death of the Reader. Flex and Herds here for your Murder Mystery World Tour, and we are here in our penultifinal week discussing the ABC murders by Agatha Christie.
Foreshadowing something that is a brilliantly important piece of any murder mystery fiction.
This is a 1935 serialization, 1936 novelization of a serial murder mystery in which the crime scene is left with a copy of the ABC Rail Guide to the United Kingdom at every corpse opened to the town that they were killed in. Names matching letters. It is our last week on the book, so full spoilers are in tow. And Herds.
Yeah, Flex, what's up?
Did you feel like Poirot's explanation of how he solved the crime made sense?
That's a good question. I feel like, here's what I feel. I've been thinking about this. I feel like Christie, as she's writing this, as she's shipping this book out, she's thinking that if you can figure out that the murder is not a serial murder in the truest sense, but is instead a singular murder covered up by many other murders, then you've kind of solved everything she wanted you to solve. Because after that point, the actual solution, not just the solution to like, how did things happen? Because there isn't much of it. It's just he went around hitting people with a stick. But the actual how they catch the criminal is just, oh, once I realized that you were the culprit, I found a bunch more evidence.
Yeah,
and
right.
Then we got you.
A lot of the solution to this murder mystery happens off screen. And
it does.
At once, I kind of like it because it means we don't have to dwell terribly long in the denouement. But it's also kind of bizarre. Like, the flow of this stretch of chapters is that Alexander Bonaparte Cust, the guy who has been framed for the crime, basically turns himself into the police.
He thinks he might have done it. He thinks maybe he's lost his marbles more than he thinks he even has.
And he also like turns himself in sort of in a state of delirium as he is realizing he might have done it.
Which does lead to quite an interesting little sequence where Poirot goes to interrogate him and he sets up the interrogation by saying, "Hastings, I expect this man's going to lie to me and that's going to give me the truth." And the lie is that he thinks he's done it. He says, "I have done the murder." That's the lie, right?
Which is a really cool way to do it, right?
Like, it is.
To us as the audience, it is very obvious at this point that it is not Cust. But I like that the way that it's sold to Poirot is that he knows crime well enough that he says, "I think this thing is going to happen." And then he is correct, but not in the way he thinks. I thought that was really cool.
If I'm going to praise this novel before we get too far into the strangeness, like, I do think that the actual drama of the story, the whole idea of the contradictions, as this chapter where Poirot lays out, you know, this character is both childish and ruthless, and they're in one place and they're in another place. It's almost like there are these two sides to this madman character that we're trying to find. But of course, the real solution is that there are two people representing the two sides of the crime, which is a classic.
Well, yeah, and I mean, that's the other thing too, is that like the last two clues that we actually sink him with is by saying that someone saw him out with Betty.
Higley, or whatever her name is.
Basically a clue that happens off screen, which Father Knox would have a word about. And then the other one is something that Poirot makes up just to scare him. We don't really have any solid evidence other than scaring this guy enough that he accidentally confesses, basically.
I do think that we are sacrificing the mystery a little bit for drama, which is not an inherently bad thing. The fact that we kind of hold off on, oh, did you see Franklin Clark, this man, here's a photo of him on the night of the Bexhill murder, Miss Higley. You know, that's not something that Poirot would necessarily think to ask until he, you know, suspected that it was Clark. So it follows, and it's a dramatic moment of, aha, I had this surprise witness the whole time. And also with the typewriter clue, where it's a callback to the previous conversation about what would be the perfect crime, what sorts of tropes are interesting to you, Hastings, you know, which again, that bookends the story. So Christie is sacrificing some of the, you know, fair playness of the mystery in order to heighten the drama, which I still think it's quite fun.
Yeah, like I think one of the strong suits of this novel and one of the strong suits of the Poirot novels that I think have lasted most in history is the ones where she makes Poirot seem actually clever. And that example we were talking about earlier where he says, I expect to be lied to, is a great example in this book of how
it's a good line.
He actually seems clever. The way that he uses counterintuitive statements in Murder on the Orient Express is a great reason that he's clever in that book. And that's one that I call on pretty often. And I think that's one of the strengths of the ABC murders, is that Poirot and Hastings and the team that works around this crime do seem clever, but it is that as a priority in a way that doesn't quite glue everything together.
I almost felt like there should have been an extra chapter. I mean, admittedly, in the e-reader I was using, it said I was at like 95% of the way through the book. So I thought, oh, there'll be like another chapter to kind of, you know, have a back and forth.
That said, though, the scene where he goes to Cust and is like, get the money off those newspapers, man, is a pretty charming way to end the story.
It's pretty good, especially after all the drive-bys that he committed against Cust's ego during the denouement.
I know, it's very silly.
So many moments.
He is unattractive and he could never get these women to do anything. And
the discrepancy between the personality of Alexander Bonaparte, Cust, bracket, who could never have made the click with any girl, end yep. bracket, and the personality of Betty Bernard's murderer. It is a core fact of the case that Cust has no game. It's bizarre. And there's like multiple sequences of this where he's like, Cust has no tact. Cust is stupid. Cust is mentally deranged. There's no way that he could have done any of these murders.
And then the book ends with him basically being like, all of this is because he's had the wrong glasses prescription.
It's bizarre. What? It's very bizarre.
Herds, have you ever had a wrong glasses prescription and suddenly your game just falls out of your pants?
You know what? Maybe I should look into that. That's something I need to get checked out. I need to get these glasses checked. Look, I think that it's like kind of cruel to Cust. I don't know how deep I kind of want to go on this, but it is bizarre that there is a fleeting moment where Christy almost seems to be like empathetic towards rehabilitation of criminals with mental health issues, but then we just throw Cust under the bus repeatedly. Like, I don't know how to reconcile the two.
But also, this really weird thing where the police sort of come in and arrest him at the end, but Poirot is only able to arrest him because he had a pickpocket that he recruited off screen steal the bullets
sequence.
From his gun. If that pickpocket had been on screen in an earlier scene in the novel, so you had something to kind of pay off, I feel like it would have stuck so much harder.
You've picked the cream of the crop there, but also, like, where did this gun come from? I don't think none of the crimes were committed with a gun. Like,
yeah.
What if he had like produced another one of his, was it a leaded pipe or whatever it is, his sticks? What if he,
yeah, like, you know, all that it's showing is
a weapon that he used earlier in the novel. You know,
he thought he was prepared for his plan to go wrong is all that it's meant to show, but it doesn't show it in a particularly interesting way.
No, it's supposed to tie it into the theme of the fox being caught in the cage.
Yeah,
he'd rather go out in a vicious mauling, so to speak, by the dogs in the hunt than being put in a box.
Which also ties back to that whole discussion that Hastings and Poirot have been having since the start of the novel, where, you know, Hastings had been off like hunting in South America or something, right?
Yes.
Because that is one of the strengths of the book, is that like Hastings and Poirot haven't worked together in a while as far as the canon goes. Like, Hastings has kind of built up these expectations that Poirot is reacting differently to over the course of the novel. Like, there's a lot of this book where Hastings is like, wait, Poirot, you can't do that?
I think that the relationship between Hastings and Poirot is one of the highlights of the novel, especially if Poirot is being a little less tactful, a little less speedy in his mystery solving, and Hastings has to kind of react to that. Also, I like that Poirot gives Hastings props for considering that the letter might have been intentionally misdirected, which
yes.
I don't think was particularly difficult to pick, but I'd forgotten he said it, honestly, but but it is something he's given credit for.
Well, yeah, because I mean, it is important that we show that the sidekick has intuition that means that they're worth being there.
For sure. Well, you know, it's always good having a detective that like shares the glory, as it were, like acknowledges that the characters that they work with have some value. It's always nice. And he does that both with Hastings and with Cust at the end of the book, which is really cute.
Yeah, there is one scene, and we'll talk about this next week on the show when we're going to cover a couple of the film iterations of the ABC murders. But there's one really great scene with Cust that has such a different energy to the book, and I'm really excited to talk about that because I feel like it's one of those cases where the show just did that scene so much better than the book did.
I'm looking forward to seeing it. I've been told about this magical scene, but I ain't seen it yet. I'm ready for it.
Yeah, looking forward to it. We are going to jump over to the mystery section at the end of today's show, though. This is Death of the Reader, your murder mystery world tour. Stick around for more of Agatha Christie's The ABC Murders. Yeah, on your murder mystery world tour.
To us, yeah.
Let's go. You're listening to Death of the Reader. Flex here for your murder mystery world tour. Now, as we continue trekking through the new year, all of the amazing Australian authors launching books, we're delighted to be joined by Dervla McTiernan, who has just put out her first book in a fair while, I think, Dervla, right?
I've been lazy. I've been chilling out at home.
But it's so exciting to have you back with What Happened to Nina, which is a story about how far a mother will go on the quest to discover what happened to her daughter who went missing. And I guess the thing that I wanted to start with is that on the show, we've covered a bunch of novels that have dealt with this particular fear of the power imbalance that a lot of women have in relationships with the men in their life. We've spoken with Michelle Prack about The Rush and a road trip gone wrong in that book. Ashley Collagen Blunt about Dark Mode. What is it you think that keeps us coming back to this theme after so many years? Why can't we get to the bottom of it?
I just don't think there's an easy answer, because it's a sad reality we still see in the headlines every day, right? I mean, we see a young woman goes for a jog and doesn't come home. You know, why? What happened? What, you know, we need to get to the bottom of it. And I think that fear lurks in a lot of us. And we read these books because in a way, it's sort of like controlling the narrative or the story for us. These novels offer us the answers that we don't always find in real life.
Yeah, because I think that's something that these stories also tend to really enjoy exploring as well, is that idea that there is some level of almost exploitation that we go through in reading these books, that idea that these people live these real lives and we're spinning them off into, you know, our true crime stories, our fictional stories, but we still have to come back to that idea that they were real people. Why was it, you know, the character of Leanne that you chose to really foothold this book with in that first chapter after the prologue?
Yeah, so Leanne, in this story, really kicks off with the young couple, Simon and Nina, as you've mentioned. So Simon and Nina go away for a weekend together, only Simon comes home. And he has a story about what happened, but it doesn't really add up. Nina's parents, including Leanne, are very concerned. They go to the police, the investigation starts. So it starts after the prologue with Leanne, and we're seeing it from her point of view. And then we go back and forth between all four parents, not just the mothers, the dads as well. I think because maybe she was the closest to me, you know, in that she's the mom of the young woman, terrified for her daughter, and possibly of all the characters, she's the one I relate to most.
Yeah, and I think also that idea that they've been friends, Nina and Simon, since they were, I think, five. It's this really kind of complicated idea where we have that family burden of all of this expectation you've built up from living for years with a person running into the real person that you're now dealing with. I mean, how do you make that feel satisfying? Because that's one of the things that in real life is so hard to wrangle with, that the people in front of you are just changing.
Well, this is, I suppose I'm really interested in it because my kids are getting older and I know their friends, or I think I know their friends. But as my kids become teenagers and grow, you begin to realize you barely really know your kids. You know, they have their own distinct separate life from you, and that's going to continue to develop. And their friends show you a particular, you know, thank you, Mrs. McTiernan, you know, face, but who are they really? And that's something I've kind of been thinking about a little bit, the independence of your child from you and what sort of life they're really leading. And it just, all of that stuff, all the things you think about in daily life, they feed into the book.
Yeah, because one of the other things with kids growing up that stood out to me in this book is how much of the character dynamic you express through someone's size. And I felt that given the very parental lens of the book, that that comes from seeing your kids grow up and suddenly getting tall, as tall or taller than you. Am I on the money
horrifying.
There?
Horrifying, 100%. My son is 12 years old. I am 5'9". He's already taller than me and his hands are like shovels. It's very disconcerting for a mother to watch that happen.
Yeah, and then especially when we get into Matthew White, who's our other narrator character, who is the, sorry, Matthew Wright, the other narrator character who is the cop on the case. Why do you think Matthew was the right, pun intended, detective for this case?
I think he felt right to me because I always intended to write this book in a way where these families are living their normal lives and this bomb goes off. And from the moment the bomb goes off, they all take one small step sideways. And suddenly they're in this slightly surreal world where everything's heightened and their decisions are not always what you and I might do, but make sense in the moment. Matthew, on the other hand, is this steady, almost metronome against the back of the book, where he is living in the real world still. The bomb didn't go off in his life. He might be investigating it, but it's not personal to him. So I always wanted that contrast between this cool-headed, rational, steady detective and this kind of heightened world the parents are living in.
Yeah, because there's a lot of accusations that get made about like the misconduct that Matthew is doing on the case. And because we're so often seeing it from the parents' perspective, we don't really know if that's true or whether they're just fishing for anything to like try and undo this bomb, as you say.
Yeah, I think he doesn't tell them much. And that might seem crazy, but then you think about it and you actually look at the time that passes in the book, it's about 5 or 6 days. So they're sharing a little bit with the families, but not a whole lot because it's very early and they don't know who could be potentially involved. But from the family's point of view, that week is a lifetime. It's only when you actually step back and say, hang on, this has been a week, guys. The police are making progress, that it all seems a little nuts. But if you get close enough to the parents, it makes sense.
We have this double purpose that Leanne is trying to serve, along with Andy, of protecting Grace as well, Nina's sister, who's sort of this other time bomb that's going off in the background of the story, where they are going to have to front up to Grace at some point and figure out how to convey this to her.
I mean, can you imagine? Your daughter disappears. She's 19, 20. She's barely an adult. And you have a teenager coming up behind her and you have to deal with everything that that means. You've got your own trauma and loss. And now you have a teenager who is, again, making her own decisions, interpreting things her own way, potentially getting herself into danger as a result of those decisions. And I think that that tension always, how much do we tell our daughter? How much do we involve her in what's going on? We're trying to keep her safe, so we're not telling her everything. But in doing that, are you putting her more in danger? That was one of the ideas I wanted to play with in the book.
And that's definitely one of the core problems that we deal with in any fiction, I guess, about relationships, but especially in familial relationships, is that idea of keeping secrets to keep someone safe coming back to bite you. Do you think, it felt to me as though the journey through the book and their decisions in keeping Grace was sort of like the other metronome. You're referring to Matthew Wright as the metronome.
Yeah.
That's sort of the rising tension.
The other ticking clock.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's funny you say that about keeping secrets, because honestly, nothing drives me more crazy in a detective TV show or a book than that stupidly kept secret, you know?
Yeah.
And as
yep.
soon as they don't tell, you go, no! Disaster is about to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But in this one, I felt like I could get away with it. It's not going on for too long and it makes sense in the context. So I'm hoping that I get the benefit of the tension without the frustration, but you guys will have to tell me whether I succeeded.
I think, saying why I think it worked is probably too much of a spoiler, but I think it worked.
You're giving me the nod anyway.
Yeah.
That's okay.
I think the other thing that's interesting about that keeping secrets from the reader idea is that Matthew Wright almost is like stuck without any way to really share information to the audience, just as much as he can't share information with the parents. Was that fun for you to play with? And what did that let you do with his narration compared to the parents?
I don't know if it was so much fun as horrible. Because it is such a challenge, because you've hit the nail on the head. I mean, having the sidekick is everything.
Mm.
Ideally, a sidekick who's new to the environment. There's a reason that Watson was coming in cold at the beginning. There's a reason for all of that, because then you've got someone to explain it to, or someone who's experiencing it anew, and therefore you get to throw it out through their eyes. Whereas we do kind of have a sidekick in this. We've got Sarah Jane, but she's not as present. So really genuinely on a technical level, you're wrangling with that as a writer. You know, how am I going to make this work? Because the last thing you want to be doing is boring a reader by telling them something, you know, in a very exposition-y kind of way.
Exactly. And I think that's one of the most impressive things about this book too, is because the prologue effectively does what in a lot of other books would be the reveal. The end is effectively the murder, and much in the same way as like Keigo Higashino did in the Devotion of Suspect X, it's then you trying to figure out what else has gone on to make this big thriller on the back end of that prologue work.
Yep.
Why was that what you chose to do with this story? Why open with what would be the answers in a lot of other books?
Oh gosh, it was, you know, I had to fight for this one, I'll be honest. People were a little bit worried, because there's always the concern that like if you give a major reveal away early, people are going to say, well, why am I reading this? I know the answers. So you need a lot of other questions that need to be answered. And the main reason I did it is because for me, this was always about the parents. It was always about what it would be like if your daughter was missing. What would it be like if your son was accused? What would you do? Once you've taken that step, what happens next? Well, you take the next step. and the next step. And I really wanted to write a story where 5 or 6 days after the bomb goes off, you don't know who you are anymore. You know, you look back at who you were on Monday and it's Friday and you're like, how did I get here?
Yeah.
But every step makes sense in that moment. And I hoped that the tension of that and the back and forth between the parents, one does one thing which provokes the other, which provokes the other, that that would make it a pacey read regardless of the fact that I've given away a big chunk in the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, the big obvious metaphor at the start of the book there is when Jamie first closes the door on Leanne and Andy, who have come to see where Nina is, and then the door reopens and it's this idea that, oh, yes, things can be repaired only for the door to be swung shut again. And it's like, oh, right, yeah, the bomb can never...
Yeah, we can never fix the bomb.
Back in the box.
Yeah, that's it.
Dervla, thank you so much for joining us here on Death of the Reader. It's been a pleasure having you and a pleasure having another one of your books on our shelves once again.
Thank you so much for having me. I love this conversation.
Dervla McTiernan there talking about her latest book, What Happened to Nina. Thank you to HarperCollins for putting us in touch with Dervla and providing copies ahead of the interview. We'll have links up on the podcast if you want to find out more. We're going to jump back in to the ABC Murders by Agatha Christie. This is your Murder Mystery World Tour on 2SER 107.3. You're listening to Death of the Reader. Flex and Herds here discussing Agatha Christie's The ABC Murders all the way to the end. Full spoilers are in the house. Now, Herds.
Yeah?
One of the things I wanted to talk about as we go into this little mystery section here, talk about the puzzle and how it was constructed. There's a scene in the book where Poirot has a go at Hastings for trying to get him to be Sherlock that I thought was a good bit of fun and kind of speaks a little bit to the way that the mystery in this book is constructed, where he says... What would you have me do? You look at me with dog-like devotion and want me to be Sherlock. I don't know what the murderer looks like. I don't know where he lives. I don't know how his hands work. If only he'd left some clue.
It is always the clue that attracts you. Alas, he did not smoke the cigarette and leave the ash, then step in it with a shoe that has nails of a curious pattern. Kind of makes fun of the simple solution, which we've complained about, that there is no simple solution. So, you know, that shows us.
One of the interesting things about this book, and one of the things you'll see in a lot of reviews of this book by Christie fans, is that it is one of her mysteries where when you get to the end of the story, you definitively can say this only could have been solved one way. But I also feel like it had to give itself a lot of leg room for that to be the case, you know?
This is what I enjoy about reading an author who has such a large library of novels that they've constructed, because you find these little nuggets where Christie is clearly trying to do something different. Obviously, as an author, you always want to write a different book to your previous one, or else you risk repeating yourself. The danger is inherent to the job. But Christie, in this novel, is attempting to create a much broader open circle murder mystery than she usually does. But clearly Christie was thinking about this idea of the smoke screen, which is a trope that we saw in the Father Brown stories. One in particular discusses the idea of, you know, if you want to hide a needle, where do you hide it? You hide it in a haystack.
It feels like a story that had a bunch of those ideas that sort of built up this story. Like, I know her grandson, Matthew Pritchard, said in an interview that like the ABC Murders was inspired by a copy of the ABC Railway Guide that she always kept like by the phone. So like there's very clearly a bunch of key inspirations that have come together to make what is in many respects a pretty inspired story.
I like that it's got that experimental angle. I like that in the same way that the culprit is committing many murders while only one of them being the significant one, Poirot asks lots of questions with only two of them being significant. The way that we gather all of these characters who, you know, seem to be all helping Poirot, but one of them is secretly trying to get him. Like this theme runs through the book. And I think that's really cool. I do think that, as you say, there is only one way to kind of solve this book. There is only one thing that is important in all of these chapters. Because something, again, that as I was trying to solve it, I was looking at was like, there's this war business and people are buying and selling stockings. Like, how can we kind of tie those things together? And the answer in the end is you can't. Like, they are pieces of the characters and their life stories. But at the end of the day, it all comes back to just this clever trick that Clark was trying to play on someone, you know?
And like, you could say that it is also a bit of a character clue in that Franklin is this boyish guy who's like, ah, what do I think of when I think women? I think nice stockings because he's a flirtatious creep. But I don't necessarily know that it goes that deep. I think the other thing that's sort of interesting about this book is the way that we have Cust as clues appear to us really early in the story. Like, we have the not from Hastings' personal journal chapter incredibly early in the story in many respects. It almost gives the game away that Cust is going to be framed because it even names him.
Well, it names him and he starts ticking names off a list, which... Oh, it's the murder list. Like, no.
Yeah, like, if you were reading anyone else other than Agatha Christie, you could kind of buy that you were having scenes from the perspective of the culprit. But it's a Christie book, right? And if it was coming out fresh at the time, maybe Christie had gone off in a new, fresh direction. But reading it almost 90 years later, it's a bit hard to suspend that disbelief as far as what crazy turns Christie might have done, because we know her reputation.
I mean, that's as always something to keep in mind as we kind of dissect these Golden Age books and these older novels, is that, like, we've seen all this before. Like, we really have.
Because, like, ostensibly what's happening in the Cust scenes is, like, an iteration of the unreliable narrator, which at this point is a crime fiction trope. But, like, at the same time, that's also part of the charm of going back and reading Christie like this, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's, as always, it's part of the show, Felix. I don't know if you know this, Flex.
What show's this, Herds?
This is Death of the Reader, your Murder Mystery World Tour, where we trace inspiration and influences across countries, across time periods, in order to understand why novels are being written today in the way that they are.
That's crazy. That sounds like
a crazy idea. I think we should make that show, but unfortunately I wouldn't know where to host it.
And I think it's also one of the reasons that final scene with Cust works so well, in that Poirot is able to sort of give Cust a redemption moment when usually it would be the sort of downward moment where we've caught the criminal. And it's not like that's an entirely novel idea even for the Golden Age, but I thought that it was done well, where Poirot and Cust were both people who Franklin had tried to use, and so they're sort of in some ways able to bond over that.
I will say, actually, I know we're in the mystery section, but there are a few characters who get either very extreme upward or downward sort of resolutions. Donald Fraser, after he's had his dreams of killing his girlfriend, but it's a psychological thing where he's, like, afraid of replacing his dead girlfriend with her sister, which is a bit weird, but... It ends with Poirot saying, do not worry about it, my friend. If you want to get with your dead girlfriend's sister, that's a thing you can do. You have my blessing. So he goes out on a high note. But then you've got Thora Grey, who apparently is a gold digger. And so she basically reveals that when she said that she would not have married Carmichael after his wife died of cancer, she was lying and she was just out for that delicious Clark money. So in a way, like, Thora and Franklin were two peas in a pod. They were both kind of scummy characters. But yeah, most of the characters in the story kind of get a resolution, a moral resolution, which I do enjoy.
I think that's one of the things with this book, is that in many ways you can see why it is such an all-time classic. It is, in so many respects, so good, but also just as much you can see that people have innovated based on its ideas. So it's a great one to go and read, and it's one that you'll definitely see when you read forward into crime fiction, and that's one of my favorite things to do. So I'm glad we got to dive into this.
We can put that one under the belt, as it were.
Almost.
Well, I mean, the novel part of it. We're going to have to dive into the big picture stage.
Yeah, next week on the show, we're going to be covering a couple of the adaptations to screen of the ABC murders. We got a week to fill until Solari Gentil's The Mystery Writer is out. And you know that we have to cover Solari Gentil because we love Solari Gentil.
We have to get in there. Solari Gentil.
And then I've got some other fun ideas, Herds, because not only does doing two sequences on Agatha Christie get the tax man off our back, but also this book is so popular that there have been a bunch of books that have, like, lifted with credit
what
stuff from this book that we have so many options for where to go after Solari's book.
We'll have to pick one. So many to choose from. So many novels. So many stories. I love it. I love being spoiled for choice.
This is your Murder Mystery World Tour here on 2SER 107.3. We'll be back with some screen adaptations of the ABC murders next week. Pick whichever one you want to watch. I've watched the ITV one with David Suchet. I'm probably also going to jump on the John Malkovich one, Herds. I don't know what you've got
lined up. I'm going to pick whatever I feel like. I still need to recover from this novel. Also, you need to tell me how many points I'm getting.
Oh my goodness, I do.
How many points am I getting, Flex?
You did so well, Herds. I just almost assumed that we were just giving you your three. You did a great job.
Thank you. It makes me feel better. makes me feel better about everything.
This is Death of the Reader. We'll be back with more of Agatha Christie's The ABC Murders next week on the show. Catch you then for your Murder Mystery World Tour.
Let's go.
We're out of here.